Where Are You, God? That's the title of a booklet I read one time, and in fact I ordered it, and because I was so taken with it and what the content was. It was the title of a small book. It was a story of many of those who cry out to someone, to something, because of the dire situation that they are in. This book was written by a Catholic sister who worked in rescue places in inner cities where they tried to save homeless children who have run away from home, now on the streets. They're into drugs, they're into prostitution, they're into whatever they can do to exist in a life that has gone terribly wrong. They failed at home, they've had difficulties with parents, step-parents, foster parents, whichever, and left hoping that somehow it would be better away from the home that they were in, only to find themselves in a much worse situation than they could ever imagine. They don't always ask the question outright, but you can see it in their eyes. You can read it in their movements. You can see the burning question that begs to be answered in their responses to life and what they do. Their life has turned to nothing. No hope, no future, stuck in an unending cycle of drugs, trying to exist, recovering for a while, returning to the only life that they've come to know. The big question is, why is it this way? How can there be such misery in the world that was, according to the Christian religion, created by a good God? And if he didn't make it that way, then why doesn't he do anything about it if he is a good God? Hence getting right to the question, the title of this particular little booklet, Where Are You, God? It's a hard question to answer. For some people, reality just doesn't agree with the pat answers of religion sometimes, and they don't seem to have the answers either. But in all of this, God tends to come under attack because there is seemingly no answer. And when a person is angry, they have to be angry at someone, whether they are to blame it or not. We tend to do those sort of things. You see, God is who he is. And he's not going to reward bad behavior or thoughts or unrighteousness of any kind. God simply won't do that. But he will answer your questions. He will come to a person's aid. If you are sincere and you're not trying to play games with him, he will even answer the hard questions. In fact, these ought to be the questions you should be asking. The hard questions, not the easy questions, not the nice prayers, but the tough prayers, one where you get down with God and you need answers. Those are the kinds, that's when you're getting through to God. But trying to make out like everything is okay, everything is nice, me and you, Lord, everything is great, I'm afraid you lost him. It doesn't work that way. You know, there was one such person in the Bible who through his struggles and trials came to understand things a lot better from God's point of view. He was asking the question. In the end, when he got the answers, he was very surprised at the answers. Answers he wasn't looking for. You see, that's the problem. We have certain things in our minds about the way things ought to be, and as a result, when it doesn't happen, we go between rage and discouragement or despair sometimes, and we don't expect the answers that God has, and so we have to wait for them. Because we try to get God to give us the answers that we want him to give. And, well, as I said, God doesn't work that way. God will give you the truth. He will be mindful of your frame, however. He will be mindful of where you're at. He will want to move you from where you are to where he is. He will certainly do whatever he can to do that. But at the same time, I think we need to understand what we have to do too. Let's talk about a man in the Bible, Jacob. Maybe you thought I was going to talk about Job. Well, we will talk about him for a moment, but only for a moment. Because you see, most everybody has had similar experiences, and Jacob is no different. Jeff Nelson mentioned David, for instance. He had certain experiences also. And they're out here asking certain questions, hard questions, tough questions, looking for answers. And let me tell you something. When you're asking those kind of questions, you're getting through to God. And we'll look at some of that in a moment. But here was a man God was working with, Jacob, one whom God would call, one who would be one whom God would extend the blessings through that were promised in Abraham. Let's look briefly at his story. I want to go through this because we have to set the scene for a certain thing that was going to happen, a crisis, as it were, where he was going to get the answers that he was looking for. And when he got those answers, there were some surprises in those answers. Briefly look at his story. Genesis 25, beginning with verse 30. Important lessons in the book of Genesis. We could spend a long time there. Genesis 25, verse 20. Jacob was his name. Well, that's how the story begins. Jacob was his name. It says, Isaac was 40, verse 20. Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah as wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Paddan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Syrian. Now Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah his wife conceived. And the children struggled together within her, and she said, "If all is well, why am I like this?" So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." Here's what God told her before they were even born. This is how it was going to be. So when her days were fulfilled for her to give birth, indeed, there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red. He was like a hairy garment all over. So they called his name Esau. In other words, he was more developed. I don't know how that would be, or the physical or medical circumstances, don't propose, but he was obviously more developed. So he came out hairy all over, and that was, of course, the kind of a person he was. Afterward, his brother came out, and his hand took hold of Esau's heel. So his name was called Jacob. No comment here about that, except if you want to read to the margin as to what Jacob might mean, because they named children sometimes after the circumstances of their birth. Esau was named Red. Well, he looked red. That's what we're going to call him, Red. Esau. And there's something about Red that played into his life a little bit later on. And they didn't seem to pick the names out prior to the birth, as we tend to do. We look through all the books and figure out, what can I name this child? And this boy or girl or whatever, and we try to pick out a name that very few other people have. I think we tend to do that. Afterward, his brother came out. Well, I think I read that, verse 20. They called his name Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when he bore them, quite young in those days. Supplanter or deceitful. Here was a person, because he grabbed the heel of his brother, this person is going to be in contention with somebody somewhere for the mastery in life. This is how he's going to do this. You might think Esau, because of his very nature, would be the one to have done it. Not so. It's Jacob who seemed to have had this particular characteristic. So the boys grew. And Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field. But Jacob was a mild man, dwelling in tents. Now, it doesn't mean he was a mild, nice sort of a man, but we find he was rather aggressive in some of his ways. Dwelling in tents. But he was a shrewd person. And Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. So we have right here a certain situation where one parent favored one of the children, Another parent favored the other one. You have set yourself up for a problem in your family the minute you do that. Not a good thing to do, but this happened to be the situation. As it was, and it so happened, it was going to work out in such a way where God's will was going to be done in terms of who would receive the blessing and the birthright that was going to be passed on to them. So Jacob was named Jacob because of the events of his birth. Supplanter, deceitful. This tells us how he's going to go about his life, at least to start with. The second, he has a hole of his brother's heel, and if he could trip him up at his very birth, he might try to trip him up later, which of course he did. Another term for that is wrestler, David the wrestler. This is going to come into play a little bit later on. Who takes hold of the heel. Now the very next incident in these two boys' life is the matter of Esau selling his birthright. Let's notice in verse 29. Now, of course, it skips quite a few years. They're both grown men now. They're both involved somewhat in Isaac's business, which was mainly pastoral, and perhaps he was also a merchant of some kind. It seems to indicate that all of them were. Now Jacob cooked a stew, and Esau came in from the field, and he was weary. And Esau said to Jacob, "Please feed me with the same red stew," there's that red again, "for I am weary." Therefore his name was called Edom, also means red. But Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright as of this day." Well, nothing shy about Jacob here. But Esau said, "Look, I'm about to die, so what is this birthright to me?" And Jacob said, "Swear to me as of this day." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. And Jacob gave Esau bread and a stew of lentils. And then he ate and drank and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. As the writer, or the ones who passed the story down to Moses, said, and Moses saw fit to keep that statement in there. And Paul himself even quotes it later on in the book of Hebrews. It says he despised his birthright. Sell me this day your birthright. Now Jacob was no doubt aware of the prediction communicated to his mother by God. The older shall serve the younger. That was said before they were born. A quiet man like Jacob would not otherwise have thought of reversing the order of nature and custom, because the oldest was to go the blessing and the birthright. Now in the later law of Moses, we find that to be true, because a double portion, according to the law, went to the oldest son, and a certain rank then as patriarch and sometimes priest of the house upon the death of the father. That's how it was seen in those days. And so the firstborn had a certain particular place then, an inheritance. Now that could be reversed by the father. When, if he was going to pass it on to another son, he could do that if he wanted to. But custom was, generally, was to go to the first one. And so Esau assumed it would always be his. Now in the case of Jacob, there was obviously a far greater significance to be the chief of the chosen family and the heir of the promised blessing, with all of the immediate benefits that goes with that, and far-reaching benefits for that matter that would go on down into history that were included. Maybe Jacob knew or didn't know as to how far that would go, but it was very, very, very far-reaching promise that was given to Abraham, and these were passed on to these boys, these children, and says, okay, here's what's going to happen, here's what's going to be passed on. Esau assumed it was going to be him. Now, knowing all of this, Jacob is willing to purchase the birthright. The type of man he is, he does so in the most peaceful way to bring about the supremacy over his brother, which was in fact destined for him. However, he's very cautious. He's prudent in how he does it, even conciliating in his proposal. But he availed himself of a weak moment to accomplish by consent what God had intended and what was to come. There was no necessity, it seems, that he is laying on Esau. He leaves it to Esau's own free choice. He endeavors to win his brother's agreement in a thing that was already settled in the purposes of God. The chief error here with Jacob lay in attempting to anticipate the arrangements of God. That is how God would bring it about, and chose to take the matter into his own hands. For Esau's part, he is strangely ready to dispose of his birthright for a trivial present gratification. Now, he may have found other means to take care of his need at the time, and isn't wanting something to eat, but Esau will sacrifice anything here for the desire of the moment. Any future value of the birthright, any high importance that's attached to the birthright, of what is involved here, seems to have escaped his view. And it shows, on the part of Esau, a callous disregard for God's spoken word that he spoke to his father and to his grandfather about these promises, a callous disregard to the beliefs of his father and grandfather about those promises which were secured at great price of obedience and faith on the part of both of them, as the story goes. And they knew it, and they understood that. Jacob, however, is deeply earnest about this. And so he makes Esau swear. And he makes Esau swear before God. So God is a witness now to this transfer of birthright to Esau, from Esau to Jacob. Now, the fact that he invokes God, he makes Esau swear, this doesn't slow Esau down a bit. It's plain that Esau's thoughts were all together on this morsel of meat or food. Not even meat, lentils, as it were. Red lentils, which were quite, let's say, prolific in those days, as the food of fare that they had to eat. So, he swears to Jacob. He eats, he drinks, rises up, goes his way. And as those who relate the story graphically describe this reckless course that Esau took, thus Esau despised his birthright. He had no respect or value that for what God had promised. How little can a person accept in a time of momentary need, no matter how much it seems or how great the need seems to be at the moment, that a person will give up just to have that need satisfied at the moment. People have done that so many times. God expects us to take, of course, the longer-term view. Now, the next incident is when it came time to pass the blessing from Isaac on to, from what Isaac thought, Esau. But nobody said anything to Isaac about this. He didn't know this. I'm not going to read the story to you. I think we understand what took place, how Jacob disguises himself as Esau. So Jacob once again resorts to taking matters into his own hands. First by deceiving his father, impersonating Esau, then lying about it. He and his mother Rebekah, who herself came up with a plan for him to receive the blessing. After all, he was her favorite, and she did receive the word from God after all, that he was the one who was going to be the greater. To receive the blessing, it would include the birthright. Neither of them seemed to have no compunction to carry out what they believed was right in a deceitful way. Jacob here is showing a characteristic that one day he's going to have to answer for to God, because he's going to work things out without consulting God. He's going to work things out without trusting God. He's going to work things out using his own wits. He's going to do things using his own strength, human ability, human reasoning, to try to get his own way. Just as Esau is a certain kind of a person, called a profane person by the Apostle Paul. And later on, Esau developing a bitterness and hatred for his brother because his brother got the best of him. So too Jacob had his issue. Jacob, as it says later, prevailed with man. It says he also prevailed with God, but he prevailed with man, using his own reasoning, using his own scheming, his own ways to get the best of other people. He tried to control things in life in ways that would have some consequences later on. Now, the first consequence we begin to see immediately. Esau intended to kill him after Isaac died. Esau says, "I'll bide my time. He did it to me this way. I'll take care of the matter once Dad dies." Nobody planned on this outcome. Rebecca hadn't thought of it, and I'm sure the thought never crossed Jacob's mind either. Little did he know that he was going to be then the beginning of a journey at this time that would result in some pretty big changes in the man Jacob. Isaac sends him away. He realizes he has to do this. He knows that Esau is out to kill him. And so he says, "It's time to go. You go to Laban, your sister's brother, and you go stay there for a while and get a wife from there. Don't get one from Canaan, like Esau was doing at the time." Isaac, perhaps at that time, his father began to see, really, the kind of a person Esau would turn out to be, and that perhaps it was best that the blessing and the birthright was going to Jacob anyway. So he sends Jacob away, leaving Esau then as the sole proprietor of the land and the inheritance that would go. However, it was in the mind of Jacob to come back. This would be the beginning of a journey when he would leave home. And this is going to begin a journey that would result in some huge changes in his life. So he leaves. And on the first night out, after leaving, he is in a place that is later called Bethel. And God speaks to him in a dream. And God brings up the main issue. God tells him, "Now this is where you ought to be, Jacob. This is the land that I promised to Abraham and Isaac and to you and to your descendants. And you need to keep that in mind, and I will be with you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land." He wanted to give Jacob some assurance. He wasn't putting a stamp of approval on everything Jacob did. He's just simply saying, "Here's what I promised I would do, and I'm going to do it." And so there it was. In spite of the hatred, the fuming of Esau, the threat against his life, God promised this, and this is what he had to keep in mind. And so Jacob vows. He performs a vow. He has a pillar of stone. He anoints it as a sign or symbol that of this vow that he makes with God. He says, "If God will keep me and be with me in the way that he was going to bring him back in peace, then God will be his God, and he will surely give God a tenth." Might seem a little bit strange he would say this, but that's the way he was thinking at that time. He says, "If you bring me back in peace, you'll be my God." Tells you a little bit about where he may be just at that time. A little bit, not exactly the point to where his father Isaac had reached, certainly not the point to which his grandfather Abraham had reached, where it was said, this is the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac. It doesn't say it's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It says that a little bit later on. Why so? Because later on, God becomes the God of Jacob, and he's making a deal with God. God says, okay. But that certainly wasn't the end of the story. There's going to be a lot more to it than that. And God had certain things in mind as to where he wanted Jacob to wear later on. Moses went to the Israelites to bring them out of Egypt several hundred years later. He says, here's what you tell them. I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, your father. So that's what I want you to tell them. So this God then was going to be the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But it wasn't the case just at this point. Not in the fullest sense, not in the way God intended for these patriarchs to have that kind of a relationship with him. So he goes to Laban. Laban accepts him as a son. This is several hundred kilometers north, perhaps a little to the east, but mostly to the north of where he is then. It is thought that Laban doesn't have any sons at that time, only daughters. Laban has some sons later, and that kind of plays into the story. But when he meets Laban, Jacob now, who is a contender, a wrestler, one who has his way, one who uses his mind and his scheming, now he meets his match with Laban. He thinks he's going to get Rachel. He makes a deal with him. Laban switches, gives him Leah instead. You remember the story. Now Jacob is tricked. Now the shoe's on the other foot. Doesn't feel too good then, does it? So, if he wants Rachel, he's got to work another 7 years. I'm not into this thing of multiple wives here. I'm not explaining that right now, so we need to forget about that. That's another part of the story. Let me just say that was a part of the custom in those days. So he had to work for another 7 years, and Laban benefits from it. Laban gets richer. Jacob then uses his wits again, makes a deal with Laban to acquire property for himself. Jacob begins to prosper. Laban still does okay, but Jacob does a lot better than him. Laban, as we find out later on, when it came to the wages, prior to this deal being made, these were just wages. That's all. Laban changes his wages 10 times. Talk about a workplace agreement. And there's not a lot he can do about it. Jacob is accepted into the household. He becomes as one of his sons. Laban probably doesn't have any sons. Now when things kind of go bad and Jacob has to make the deal for his own property, he says, tell you what, you give me all the speckled and the colored animals, and you take the white ones. Laban says, I'll go for that. Jacob has to start acquiring his own property. He doesn't have any. It all belongs to Laban. The head of the chieftain owns everything, including the guy and his wives. That was the custom. Unless they were released. And we see they had to be released a little bit later. Jacob is stuck. He's in a situation where the property that he begins to accumulate, as I said, even his wives still belong to the head of the clan and his children. And even though it's his property, he made a deal, Laban can still claim this. So he takes matters into his own hands again. Once again, deceitful. He tells his wives, we're out of here. He packs them up while Laban is away shearing somewhere. And he says, time to go. And they agree to it because they say, we don't have an inheritance either. Because there were some sons who came along at that point, or let's say by then. And so they realize they've got to go. And He sneaks away, he gets down the road a ways until Laban catches him. Laban has blood in his eye, and the only thing that saves him, God warns Laban in a dream, you better not hurt him. Now, Laban catches up with him. They have a rather animated and spontaneous and heated discussion at times about, why did you do this? And then Jacob jumps all over him. You could see there was a problem here. But they come to an agreement. Laban releases him and his wives. And Jacob is now on his way again, but barely. There is at this point a complete break on that part of his past. He leaves Laban. And he's going back now to the land that was promised him, where God told him he was to be. Only one problem with that. Esau is still around the place somewhere. And he knows he's going to have to deal with that. But he knows what God says. That's the land I am passing on to you. So here's where it's all going to come out. He's got to face Esau. He's either going to die, or Esau will bury the hatchet. It's going to come down to this. This is something now. For the first time in his life, he can't control. He began to realize that with Laban, there's somebody else around who can put it over on me as well as I put it over on him. That idea began to get through to his head. Now, when he goes back, knowing that he's going to have to somehow front up to Esau, he knows this is a situation that is out of his hands. He can't control it. Genesis 32. Here's where we come down to the crunch. I related that story because this is where it all happens, right here. He sees, he's crossing the Jordan. There's another river he has to cross by the name of the Jabbok River. He is well on his way into the area where he grew up and close to where Esau had moved. Now, that's a very interesting part of the story. Isaac is smart enough to know that if this land is going to come back to Jacob, the land of Canaan, he's going to have to send his other son away. Now, Abraham did this. Abraham sent Ishmael away. Abraham sent the sons of Keturah away. The patriarchs did this so that there would be no conflict in the family. Here we have Esau not living in Canaan. He's down in Mount Seir. That's a rough part of the country, but that's where he goes. And all the time that he is gone, he has made, let's say he has had wives from Egypt, he had had wives from that part of the country, wives of the from Ishmael, and he's built up quite a bit of a clan himself. He has quite perhaps children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren by this time. He's had he's got 400 men. Esau is a man who lives by the sword. He's got a whole different way of life altogether. That's the way Esau has chosen. This is what Jacob's now having to deal with. He comes back to meet Jacob. I'm sorry, Jacob comes down to set the story in chapter 32. And when he does, two angels meet him. This is more incidental, but he saw them. He says, this is God's camp. And he says, this is where the host of God is. God begins to give him reassurance that you're doing the right thing. Just keep going. Keep doing what you're doing. Now, God wasn't leaving him, but and there was going to be a closer encounter that was to come. This wasn't the final encounter. This was only one to give him some kind of assurance that God was still there. So he crosses over the Jordan, he comes up to the Jabbok River, and he's ready to cross there. He sends messengers to Esau to say he's back in the land. You gotta face it. You just gotta face the issue. Sometimes there are issues in our lives that hang around for a long time. That's the way it was with Jacob. Some say he was gone 20 years. There are other scholars who say it was actually 40. It was 20 years he lived with Laban. It was a lot longer than that, one suspects. These issues hang around a long time. They don't go away. And so there they are. 40 years. Esau is in Mount Seir. He's not in the land of Canaan. As I suggested, Isaac probably sent him away too. And Isaac then would become his own clan. And he would not come under the rule of the appointed one of the patriarch, who was Jacob. So he removed Esau. Smart move. Let's save a lot of trouble. Get him out of there. And he can make his own way. And it turns out Esau was going to establish his own nation. That was a part of the prophecy that was given to his mother, Rebekah, in any case. But Esau has to be faced. And along with it, the burning question in his life. And here's what it's all going to come down to. Am I going to do things my way? Or am I going to trust God? Am I going to serve God with a converted attitude? How many Christians do this? You need to think about that. They know God. They know of God. They know of God's ways. They take on God's ways. They begin to live by some of God's ways. But they're not wholly and completely with it. This is Jacob. You see, everything had to change. And it was all going to change at this time. God expects us to become completely converted. Not just give lip service to God. And not just give lip service to his true teachings. There's a lot more to it than that. We're talking about the mind. We're talking about the heart. We're talking about one's entire life. Jacob knew he wasn't right with God in this respect. He knew of the God of Abraham and Isaac who spoke to him. But God also knew he did not have the heart and mind of God. God was only the only God Jacob had ever known. Jacob had recognized the true God among all the other gods of the people around him. He knew the truth. But God wanted more than that. Now it was crunch time. And the issue with Esau was a vice grip in which Jacob was in. How was he going to obey God, go back to the land, living it in peace? And so far as he knew, Esau would kill him, take captive his wives, servants, children, all his possessions. He would lose everything. It would all come to an end. You know, there are issues in our lives that could stop us cold, too. A lot of us have those issues. Sometimes they don't go away that easy. They come down to verse 6 in Genesis 32. We see something beginning to happen, and I think you can see it here. The messengers returned to Jacob, saying, "We have come to your brother Esau, and he is also coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him." This doesn't sound good. He knows it's over right at this point. If something doesn't happen. So Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. This is an understatement. I mean, he sees the end near. That's how he sees this. This is how he reads it. Esau is coming. Somehow Esau knew he was on his way. So Esau mounts up, 400 men, and he's on his way. Esau is living by the sword. That's the kind of a guy he is. And that's how he made his way in the world. And now he's going to meet his brother, the one that he said he would kill when he saw him again. He divided the people that were with him, and the flocks and herds and camels, into two companies. And he said, if Esau comes to one company and attacks it, then the other, which is left, will escape. Then Jacob said, notice this, O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, the Lord who said to me, return to your country and to your family, and I will deal well with you. See, this is what it comes down to. You going to believe what God says or not? You going to go all the way with him? He says in verse 10, I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies of the truth which you have shown your servant. For I crossed over this Jordan with my staff, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me now, I pray, from the hand of my brother and from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me and the mother with the children. For you said, I will surely treat you well and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. Well, here it is. Now he says, deliver me. Never said it before. He took matters into his own hands. Remember, he was the supplanter. He was the deceitful one. He was the one who was always able to make things work for himself in his own way, using his own wits, no matter what the methods might be. And this is quite different from the way you see Jacob before. You see, he's brought to this point. God sometimes, God all the time, without fail, that he's working with you, he will put you in a situation where you have to look to him and you have to pray this kind of a prayer. All the things that you do to try to take matters in your own hands to try to work them out are over. That's where you're at. I'm not saying you don't do some things for yourself. He divided himself up into two companies. Maybe that was the thing to do. He says, I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies of the truth which you have shown your servant. That's a little bit different than when he said to Esau, sell me your birthright. A little bit different, isn't it? We have a total change of attitude. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother. Will we do what God says, or will our greatest fear stop us? That is the question. So God has put him in a position, no matter what he does, he can still face extinction. And God isn't telling him. He isn't giving him an answer. He needs to go forward as if it's going to happen. So the night before God meets him, he meets Esau, a man wrestles with him. And we find out later that this wasn't just an ordinary man. This was God, who came in the form of a man. I realize the book of Hosea calls it an angel, but sometimes God, the one who became Jesus Christ, is sometimes called the angel, back in the book of Exodus. But he was the one who was with Israel. Now he was here. He was coming, and he comes in the form of a man, as he has previously done with his grandfather, Abraham. Appeared in the form of a man, had a discussion with him. Now he comes in the form of a man, and a wrestling match takes place. And he wrestles with him. Now this has come to typify our wrestle with our own issues, where we may be asking the hard questions of God. Jacob was doing that, and he has a surprise coming. Now, you know, the great men of the Bible had some very frank and forthright discussions with God. They had a relationship with God that's sometimes hard for us to believe. You and I do show, rightly so, respect and awe and worship when we come to God. These men asked the hard questions of God. And in the end, they had some surprises. But unless you're willing to go all the way, unless you're really willing to get right down to the core, as it were, the hard questions, you're not going to get the answers you need to have. And the answers do not lie necessarily in the questions that you ask God. It's in the questions he asks you. Job was asking questions. Nobody could answer him. His three friends couldn't. Job made statements like, if you remember his story, nobody can know what God is doing. How are you going to find out? Where is wisdom anyway? There is no justice. None of you can know why things are the way they are. God doesn't tell you. And after Job had his say for chapter after chapter, then God had his say. And when he did, God started asking a lot of questions. God unleashed a torrent of rhetorical and sometimes sarcastic questions upon Job. He says to Job, "Why do you talk without knowing what you're talking about? Where were you when I created the earth? Tell me, since you know so much. Do you know the first thing about death? Speak up, even if you have the beginning of an answer. Do you presume to tell me what I'm doing wrong? Do you know where light comes from? Where does darkness live? Of course you know that, don't you, Job?" It's tough talk, isn't it? See, one thing I want you to understand, Job was honest with God. He was honest with God because he loved God. And he was able to stay engaged in their relationship even when we're off base and you don't have all the answers, even when you're wrong, you still have to be able to engage God because you love him and you know he'll be honest with you. Is that what you're looking for? If you're looking for honesty, you'll get it. If you're not looking for honesty, forget it. You won't get it. God won't be completely honest with you. I'm serious. But you need to be looking for it. But see, he's got to know that. And if you're always nice to God, always putting on the front in your prayers, making out that everything is all right, playing games with God, you've lost him. You're afraid to say to God, "God, I've got a problem here. Here's what it is. I don't understand what you're doing. I don't understand why the situation is. There's a lot I don't understand. In fact, I'm starting to question you." You know, God's not easily offended. Some of you think he is. God is not easily offended. Do you think you can talk to him this way? You want answers? You need to talk to him. Now, you see, one of the reasons we don't get down to the real issues that God knows that we're dealing with is that we're afraid of what we might hear. We're afraid of what he might tell us, or what he might ask us, or what he might ask of us sometimes. Now, you can take a look at the Psalms. What are the questions David asked him? "Why have you forsaken me? Why do you stand afar off? Why do you hide in times of trouble? Why have you forgotten me? Why do I go mourning because of the oppression of the enemy? Don't you understand? If I don't get deliverance from you soon, I'm history." I'm putting it in modern language, but that's what David was saying to God. David was honest with God. He could have that kind of relationship where he could ask God the questions, and he could expect the answers. And some of those Psalms where he's asking the questions, you read on and you'll find how he understood those answers. But I'll tell you what, he did ask those questions. He posed them to God. So God meets Jacob when he's alone. It says the man wrestled with Jacob. What is wrestling? You know, we talk about wrestling ourselves sometimes. We've used this term. We speak of wrestling with God. Sometimes I don't know that we know what it really means. You wrestle with God? What does it mean to wrestle with God? You see, there's a point that God wants us all to come to in our lives where we front up to God with the hard questions. And sometimes the hard questions, the answer is quite simple, but generally the one that we've been avoiding. Then God meets us. And we can go no further until we wrestle with God. Some of us are still at the Jabbok River, proceeding no further because we've met God and we've retreated. We're afraid to ask the hard questions because of what he might tell us. But isn't that what we're here for? With Jacob, here's the thing he dreaded. The whole time he was gone, the reason he was sent away in the first place, we dread turning to God completely for what we know is there and what we now have to face sometimes. We may have put off the inevitable, but there comes a time when we have to face it. Jacob came face to face with God, as we're going to see here. Wrestling means, we're speaking spiritually, but in this sense it was physical. It means you put your whole strength to the test, to best the other person before he bests you. God is showing Jacob in this way that he is willing to be wrestled with. He takes the form of a man with limited strength, one that matches Jacob, or perhaps in some ways slightly superior. God wants to know, how much do you want this? Are you willing to face your fears? Can you enter a relationship with God to where you need to know? You've got to have the answers. And when you find you cannot have a relationship with God except you hold on to seek God's answer and God's intervention. You see, he was a man who knew God. He even trusted him, so far as that goes. But he was not duly subordinated to God in that absolute reliance. Hence, he took a lot of matters into his own hands over the course of his life. And now they were all coming to bear. He was about to learn the lesson of unreserved reliance on God. So the man encountered him in the very point in which he was strong, contending with men, taking them by the heel as he did from birth. And his life had been a constant and successful struggle with his adversaries. He had always won. And when the man with whom he wrestled saw that he could not prevail over Jacob, true to his character, struggles while life remains, the man touched the socket of his thigh, rendering him powerless to do anything except to hold on. He's completely disabled now. By one touch, he cannot even stand on his own. And he learns at that moment by experience that he himself is actually helpless. And he learns the true practice of sole reliance on one mightier than himself. This is the turning point of what is seemingly a very strange drama. The mighty stranger says, "Let me go, for dawn arises." Jacob holds on. "I will not let you go until you bless me." Despairing of his own strength, he's still Jacob, still holding on, but he knows that he's in the hands of a higher power, one who can disable or enable, one who can curse or bless. But he knows now he is utterly helpless without the healing or the protecting power of the one who has conquered him. And even if he dies, he will still hold on. He will not let him go without receiving the blessing. Jacob's sense of total disability and utter defeat is now the secret of his power with his friendly vanquisher. It's at this moment that we have a surprise. This man asked him, "What is your name?" He said, "Jacob." And he said, "Your name shall be no longer called Jacob," verse 28, chapter 32, "but Israel, for you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed." He said, "You have a new name, because while you may have prevailed with men, now you have prevailed with God." So he said, Then Jacob asked, "Tell me your name, I pray." And he said, "Why are you asking my name? What is your name?" That's the issue. Who are you? What are you all about? That's been the question all along, Jacob. Don't you understand this? Let's get it through. Let's do it right now. Who are you? Can you understand this? Can you grasp this point? So the answer he gets is not what he expects. What you came here for is to find out who you are. You need to know who you are. Why are you asking me who I am? That was never the question. You see, when this exchange takes place, then Jacob is blessed. Verse 30. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel. For I have seen God face to face, for my life is preserved. And just as he crossed over Peniel, the sun rose on him and he limped on his hip. And so he limps as he goes out to meet Esau. With the full confidence, this is going to go okay. But in his own strength, he has that limp for the rest of his life to remind him who he is, what his name is, and what his true strength is. You see, is wrestling God only for Jacob? Is seeing God face to face only for Jacob? We need to ask God some questions. We ought to ask him the right questions. Psalm 24, verse 6, let me show you something here, which is perhaps little known about this particular incident. Psalm 24, verse 6. This is Jacob, the generation of those who seek him, who seek your face. What is he talking about? He's referring back to this incident. This is the generation that seek him, describes the race of those who seek him. This is their character. The word generation here is used evidently in the sense of a race, people or persons. But it's the character or description of the persons who seek his favor or his character of his true friends. That seek your face, O Jacob. This is the race of Jacob. Who is Jacob? Who is Israel? His name was turned or changed from Jacob to Israel. These are the ones who were sincere. They sought the face of God. And here now becomes a distinction between the true and the false Israel, between those who profess to be the people of God and those who really were his people. Romans 9, and verse 6 through 8. This is denotes what constitutes the true Jacob. Who are really God's people? Who are really those who will come face to face with God? Romans 9, verse 6. But it is not that the word of God has taken no effect, for they are not all Israel. Who are Israel? Nor are they all children because they are the seed of Abraham. But in Isaac your seed shall be called. And that is those who are the children of the flesh. These are not the children of God, but the children of the promise are counted as the seed. For this is the word of the promise. At this time I will come and Sarah shall have a son. And he says, here's who it's going to be. I realize we're talking about, he's referring to a physical genealogy, but he's also saying this, as David says, the generation of those who seek him, this is the true Jacob. Those who seek the face of God. Seeking the face of God means you want God to look at you. Take a look. And then listen. What does God have to say? And then that's the time to be quiet and let him speak. Those are the ones who properly belong to God as his true people. Well, that's the story of Jacob. That's what it means to wrestle with God. When we come down to it, we all have our hard questions. We all have our issues. And it's only one way we're going to get down to it, with God to speak to us, because we are absolutely sincere, wanting to know the answer. Thank you very much.